When he was 9 years old, Nate Staniforth went to the Ames Public Library in search of magic spells. Instead, he found a book about sleight of hand and got hooked on magic tricks. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. These days, Nate Staniforth is a professional magician, but he's still searching for the real deal, a quest that has taken him across the globe. He's written about his journey in the new book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. I'll talk with him about making magic for others, what he learned from his travels, and where he finds wonder and magic in his own life. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Like so many kids, Nate Staniforth was interested in magic. He took that interest a little further than most kids, mastering magic tricks and even performing at other kids' birthday parties. He became a professional magician, but in spite of his growing success, he felt something was missing, and he went off to search for real magic. He's written about his quest in the new book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. He's going to be performing in Des Moines. Des Moines Performing Arts is hosting him for a show on April 6th at 6th and 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Temple Theater. And he is here with me now. Hello, Nate.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, we've talked a little bit about this in the past, and you write about this in the book, but let's go back to when you were 9 years old. So you'd read The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And been captivated by the magic in the book.
Yeah, just imagine for a second, you're 9 years old, and you read this book about people who can do actual magic. You know, there's that scene really early on when Gandalf the Wizard causes fireworks, magical fireworks at this party, and everyone just runs screaming. And you know, if you could do that on the playground, you'd be unstoppable. And I very much wanted to be unstoppable. So I thought, you know, I will go. Nine is such a curious age because you're old enough to get through 1,300 pages of fantasy literature, but young enough to hold out hope that maybe there is such a thing as real magic in the world. And, you know, if there is, surely you could read about it in the adult section of the library. And so I went and looking for a book of spells. That's what I was trying to figure out. Turns out that's not how magic works, but I did learn how to make a coin disappear.
So you found a book about sleight of hand, and you decided you wanted to be able to do a trick. But I find it fascinating that, you know, a lot of kids get those packs, you know, like, hey, become a magician.
Like a magic
trick. Right. Yeah. Here are some tricks you can do. You spent hours and hours learning that trick to make a coin disappear.
Yeah.
You stood in front of the bathroom mirror doing it. I love that you talk about your mom buying a carpet sample because she got sick of the sound of the coin.
Dropping the coin on the floor over and over again. Yeah, sure.
So what do you think drove you to spend all, I mean, most kids would have given up or said, hey, that's pretty good.
I think for most kids it wouldn't be a coin trick that caught their imagination. But I think many kids find something they latch on to that they, you know, they focus on to the exclusion of all else. Sometimes it's video games, sometimes it's sports. For me, this was my thing. I just became captivated with this idea that if I practiced long enough, I could make something happen that looked like magic. That's all I wanted from the world, is to get that right. And so, yeah, for a few months, I would just practice over and over and over in the bathroom in front of the mirror, before school, after school. That's what I did.
So once you mastered that coin trick, you did it on the playground at school.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, the thing that most people don't consider is that when you go to a magic show and watch a magician, there is a certain context in place that allows you to enjoy that experience. You are at a theater, you bought a ticket, you're watching a show. So you could see the most incredible things in that performance, and you are still watching it in the context of a performance. But on the playground, The other students didn't know I was a magician. They had no context. They just saw something disappear. I mean, imagine right now we're talking. Imagine if your teacup just vanished. That would not be a small experience, right? You would run screaming from the room. And so I made this coin disappear on the playground, and the other kids didn't laugh. They didn't clap. They just started shrieking and running away. And I thought, this is interesting.
That was your Gandalf
moment. I didn't
moment.
Expect that. Yeah, but that's exactly what I was going for.
So then a teacher comes over.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine you're the teacher on duty at the playground, and you look across the schoolyard, and you see this clump of children start screaming and running away, and there I am standing in the center. So she stormed across the schoolyard, and I was terrified of this teacher. And she towered above me and demanded that I show her whatever I showed them, you know, to make them run. So I made the coin disappear for her too. And I will remember the transformation that came over her face forever. One moment it was stern, authoritarian, angry, and the next it was just pure white light through the clouds, wonder. And I thought, that is even more amazing than the trick.
Do you think that that is the moment that really got you hooked on being a magician?
Oh, for sure. Without any question, yeah. Because I think, I mean, one of the things that you learn, and I'm not the only magician who would say this, one of the things you notice very early on as a young magician is the extraordinary change that comes over, especially adults, when they watch magic. Parents, friends of parents, teachers, you know, adults sort of carry themselves in one way. And then the magic happens and they just look like children again. And that you become aware of this loss, you know, you lose something with age. And from the very beginning, my interest in magic has been in relation to that question. What is it that you lose with age and how do you get it back?
As you were practicing these magic tricks, performing at kids' birthday parties, and you had this idea that you wanted to grow up to be a professional magician, what was the first trick that you created yourself?
Sure. It was so I would say, first of all, just to put this answer in context, that I grew up before the internet was widely available, before YouTube. Now when you're learning magic, you can, you know, go online and find all sorts of different sources to learn. But I was limited to everything that I could find in the public library or anything that I could invent. And the realization that I could just dream up a magic trick and then find a way to make it work, that felt incredible. That felt like this wonderful challenge. How do you make something that other people will think looks impossible? And I remember I was playing around with the coin vanish, and I realized that if I changed the sleight of hand sequence, I could change the effect that the audience saw. Instead of disappearing, I could make it look like it just pushed through my hand. So you put it on top of your hand and push it, and it falls out the other side. And that act of creation, of making something that I hadn't learned from somewhere else, that I had just sort of dreamt up and invented, I wanted to do that as often as possible. You know, once you do that, why would you do anything else?
So as you were growing and going through high school, you went to college at the University of Iowa. You had this dream of becoming a professional magician. That's not a major at the University of Iowa, at least not yet. But while you were in college, you were dreaming up these pretty spectacular tricks.
Yeah, I was not a particularly attentive student. I came to the university on an acting scholarship because I thought that studying stagecraft would be the way to make my show better. I knew from the beginning that when I left school, I was going to go into professional magic. But what I learned very quickly was that college, and especially here in Iowa City, offered so many opportunities to perform for people that I was learning far more about magic outside my schoolwork than I was inside my schoolwork. There was an art gallery above a bar downtown that gave me a show every week, and the same audience kept coming back week after week. So very quickly, I realized I had to come up with new magic or learn new magic to show them every week. And that was, you know, the beginning of the end, my success as a student. But I learned a lot, frat parties, sorority parties, just doing magic on the Ped Mall. And it was an education, but not the one that I intended to get.
There's this moment in your book when you write about you're riding in a car with a friend. You both have big dreams. You've always had this dream of becoming a professional magician. And she asks you, no, really, what are you going to do when you graduate? Yeah. And you said, become a professional magician, yeah, like I've always said.
Right.
Were you worried that other people's dreams were falling away? Did that cause you any crisis of confidence that, wait a minute, maybe this dream I developed when I was 9 years old, maybe that's not a thing that grownups do?
I think one advantage that I had growing up and living in Iowa was that I didn't know how hard professional magic would be or how few people actually make it work, because there were no other, I had no other, friends or competitors in the area who were trying to do the same thing. And so I had this, I was totally naive, and that was a great asset, because I had this thing that I wanted to do. And, you know, I think if I had the ability to go back and tell that younger version of myself how hard it would be, I think that'd be a disservice, because I was absolutely committed. And then, so it wasn't even a question. This is what I'm going to do, and I'll just figure out as I go.
So you moved to Los Angeles,
yeah,
and decided to become a professional magician. You rented out your own theater.
I did.
And tried to just put on a show. How'd that go?
Yeah, it was an unmitigated disaster. I don't think it could have gone worse, because apparently, you know, that's not how it's done. You can't just rent out a theater as a 21-year-old or 22-year-old or however old I was and expect to sell out every night. My only marketing budget was 1,000 postcards that I had printed and then a corner ad in LA Weekly that I ran one time. I just sort of assumed that would be enough. You know, I thought
Would get around.
If the show is good enough, people will leave and bring their friends. What I hadn't considered is that getting people to come in the first place is the main challenge. So that was a pretty lean summer for me, because very few people came to the show, and you know, the rent for the theater is the same either way. They don't care if you're selling tickets or not.
But one night, only one person showed up.
Yeah, and he brought a book just in case the show wasn't good enough. I couldn't believe it. I walked out on stage, and not only is there only one person in the audience, but he had a novel on his lap, like a paper bag, in case he didn't connect with the show. But he looked around and realized that he was the only person there, and immediately just stood up and asked for his money back and left.
And you took the money out of your wallet.
I did.
And just gave it back to him.
$15, yeah.
You tried to get him to stay, right?
Well, I thought maybe I could just do some close-up magic for him. But he had some unkind things to say about the whole venture. And, you know, it's hard in Los Angeles. It's hard going anywhere and parking. And he had put in some effort to get to this theater. So I understand his frustration, but that was a bad night for sure. Thanks for bringing it up,
yeah,
Charity.
No problem. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is magician Nate Staniforth. He's just published his first book. It's called Here Is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. He'll be performing in April in Des Moines at the Temple Theater on April 6th and 7th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is magician Nate Staniforth. He has been performing magic for a long time, since he was 9 years old in Ames, Iowa, and he has just published his first book. It's called Here Is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. And just before the break, Nate, we were talking about your attempt to break through in L.A., renting your own theater, putting on your own show, hoping that it would just catch fire. And it didn't, but you did have a breakthrough. So you ended up getting signed with an agent who started booking you at colleges,
yeah,
right?
At the end of the summer, I got an offer to do a college tour, which was an amazing way to learn to be a performer, because it was so many shows, just like flipping a light switch. Suddenly I was on the road all the time doing shows. And, you know, every college in the country has a student activities budget that is spent to bring speakers and comedians and like wax hands and photo booths to campus. And they also bring magicians. And so these shows are free to students, and the school pays for the performer to come in and do a show. And so, yeah, I started touring on the college circuit, and some nights it would be for 12 people in the campus coffee shop, and for some nights it would be 1,200 people in the gymnasium. But it was an amazing way to learn how to make the show work either way.
And I was surprised that there wasn't any rhyme or reason as to where you were booked. You were just crisscrossing the country.
Yeah, when you're famous, you can plan your tour with some, you know, geographical coherence. So you play Omaha and then Des Moines and then the Twin Cities and then cut over to Madison and then to Chicago. But on the college circuit, you don't get paid on the nights you're not working. And so you just say yes to everything. And that means that some, like, you wake up in Orlando and then you fly to Portland, Oregon to do the show. And then you're in Wachapeka, Kansas the next night. And then you go to Maine. You know, it's just sometimes, like, I would, in my busiest times of year, I would connect through Chicago most days on my way from one side of the country to the other. Which was disorienting, to say the least.
You actually write about getting recognized at the coffee shop in O'Hare.
Yeah, they thought I worked at the airport, right? Because I was there every day.
So this time you're honing your craft as a performer. I want to talk about how people react to your performances. And I realize your show has evolved over time, and probably some of those reactions have changed over time as well. But, you know, here you're playing to people who didn't necessarily pay to see you. So they come in not with a lot of expectations. You talked about that sort of sense of wonder and amazement that you saw on the playground and on your teacher's face. And I know that's what you're going for. But when somebody knows, oh, hey, I'm going to go watch a magician, there's an attitude that comes into the room with the audience. It almost sounds like they're your adversaries to begin with. Tell me about that feeling.
Yeah, that's, and I think many magicians would have recognized this. It's fascinating. At a magic show, it's as if the audience forgets that the performer is watching them during the show. And, you know, I'd go out and do these college shows, and even now in my theater show, I'll walk out on stage and there is a percentage of the audience that starts the show, arms crossed, head down, as if they came for no other reason than to just figure all of the material out. And one of the greatest parts of my job is watching those people just sort of melt during the course of the performance. And, you know, they start sort of hardened and cynical about the whole process. But there is a moment, and it's a different moment for each of them, but there's a moment where it just turns. And for a second, it's like they're nine again. And then the show ends and they close back up and go on their way. But for a moment, that experience of breaking through to them finally is unbelievable.
Was that hard for you at first to see how closed people were? I mean, I think of you talking about how you came to magic and this excitement and this sense of wonder and this wanting to share it with other people. Was that sort of a shock that people weren't looking for the same thing?
It was confusing. It presented a sort of mystery because there was such a vast discrepancy between how our culture talks about magic in this very dismissive way and then the deep, visceral, powerful response I was getting from my audience during the show. And it made me really consider how our culture relates to the unknown and things that we can't explain, because there's just a wild discrepancy. You know, magic in our culture, if you ask the average American to describe a magician, they will describe someone between like Job from Arrested Development and Elvis, right? The sort of Las Vegas showman,
right,
with laser beams and smoke
David
machines and tight leather pants.
And
just that whole showman style of magic. That's how I think people perceive the magician figure in our culture. But if you put those same people in a theater and show them a magic show, they do not respond with irony and they do not respond with cynicism. they sort of, for a moment, completely commit. And, you know, if you, let me say it this way, if you gave me the challenge of doing a show and I needed to get a standing ovation at the end of it, like that, you do whatever you need to, but at the end you need a standing ovation, I would pack that room with lawyers and doctors and engineers and nurses. Like, give me the most analytical, rational people who don't think they want to be there, because they are just as easy to enchant with the show, but the turn is so much more powerful.
Sometimes people get angry when they see you perform magic, when they can't figure out the trick or they don't understand what's going on. Tell me about that reaction.
I remember there are a few moments in my time on the college circuit where, you know, usually after the show, people come up to get pictures or an autograph. They just want to say thank you. But once in a while, people would come up afterwards because they couldn't get past the fact that they didn't know how to explain what happened in the show. And sometimes those conversations would go better than others. And I would always try to contextualize it by explaining that magic is fiction, that in the moment it should feel real. Just in the same way when you go to see Peter Pan, you buy into the fact that you're watching real magic, right? Mm-hmm. But no one leaves the theater and says, oh, that was fun, but I don't think those were real pirates, you know? it's understood that
we're playing pretend together.
Yeah.
Right.
I think magic sometimes angers people because it feels so real that you're not suspending your disbelief. The magician is suspending it for you. And
do they feel like you're making a fool out of them?
I think certainly in a bad magic show, that's the experience. But as a magician, you learn, you know, deceiving people is only half the job. And that's the same job that a playwright has or a film director has or a novelist has. You have to structure your creation in a way that people buy into it and accept it as real for a moment. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time. But the second half of the job is sort of taking the audience by the hand and bringing them through that experience in a way that frames it as a positive one. I think when magic shows go badly, it's because the magician succeeds in fooling the audience but fails in guiding them through that experience so it feels helpful and useful, like you're sharing something with them. Look, I think magic, when magic's bad, it's worse than just about anything in the world. But when it's good, it does succeed in, you know, wonder is a very personal, very private experience. And when magic really feels like magic, when it doesn't feel like a trick, when it feels real, it creates this sense of wonder. And sometimes, especially in an adult audience, it's been a long time since the audience has felt that way. And I think the anger at a magic show comes from the fact that it's hard to be in the world, and the world is a tough place. And sometimes being brought unexpectedly to that place of wonder is an uncomfortable reminder.
You've actually had people tell you, people who clearly get to that sense of wonder but are concerned that you are dealing with forces beyond your control, that there's something satanic about what you're doing.
I did have someone, it was 2 years ago now, someone put a hex on me after the show because she thought I was getting too close to powers that I didn't understand. It's the first time I've ever been hexed before.
How's that worked out?
I don't know. We'll see how this book does.
You know? Time will tell. So it's hard to imagine for me, talking with you, knowing what you do and knowing how sincere and excited you are about magic and reading about the incredible hard work you put into developing magic tricks and your performance and performing. It's hard to imagine this crisis of confidence that you went through. What happened? What took the magic away?
I started touring when I was 22 years old. And the thing about doing so many shows in a year is that it's a very lonely experience because not only are you on the road all the time, but no one you know understands what you're doing because everyone had gone to medical school or law school or was working a job or it's just impossible for anyone to relate to the experience of going on tour. No one does that.
Right. And you're also you got married.
Yeah, I got married when I was 23.
After, right.
Yeah, right. And Catherine worked as a nurse in Chicago and we didn't see each other very often. And so on top of the professional considerations, there were just a number of personal challenges that come from living out of a suitcase and traveling around the country. But I would also say that I think most professions, especially most professions where you have to work really hard to enter, right, to get into in the first place, that many jobs conceal behind a sort of glamorous veneer, this grinding day-to-day reality. It's one thing to want to be an architect. It's another thing to go to architecture school and pass all of those seven tests and then spend your career grinding out houses. Like, I'm sure that our perception of how amazing it must be to be an architect is at odds with the day-to-day reality. And the same was true for magic. When you're on tour, in the way that I was on tour, my alarm went off at 3 a.m. And I'd usually drive for a couple hours to get to the airport and then have two flights because I wasn't performing in New York and Chicago. I was performing most of the time in small, out-of-the-way places where you'd have a couple flights and then a two-hour drive in the rental car. And so, you know, most days I would travel for 12 to 14 hours before I even got to the theater. And then you have load-in and sound check and set up. And then there's this wonderful 90-minute period where I get to go on stage and do this thing that I love. But as soon as I'm done, I have to pack the whole show up, go back to the hotel, sleep for 4 hours before waking up at 3 the next day. And you do that over and over and over again. So it's not that I didn't love the shows. I've always loved the shows. But doing magic was such a small, percentage of the total time spent being a professional magician that after 5 years of that, I was exhausted. And I realized that for being a professional magician, I had very little in my day-to-day experience that could be described as magical.
You actually reached this breaking point on stage.
Yeah.
What happened?
There was a bad night in Milwaukee where I just, about halfway through the show, I just said goodnight. I'm done. I'm going to go now. And I walked off and I went back to my hotel. And it was just, I realized all at once how far I had come from that 9-year-old version of myself who really loved being a magician. I think the 9-year-old version of me wouldn't have been particularly impressed with that 26-year-old version of me. And 26 is pretty young to just capitulate to the weight of the world ruining everything, right? I had enough fight left in me then to think, I've got to stop. I want to stop. I want to just not do this and figure out how to sort of dream it all up again.
So you had this moment, and I think a lot of us, whatever our jobs are, have had those days where you're like, well, what else can I do?
Yeah.
So you went pretty far down that rabbit hole trying to figure out what else could you do?
The universe is a strange and mysterious place, and sometimes incredible things just happen on their own. And on that night in Milwaukee, when I went back to my hotel room, on that leg of the tour, I had just happened, just by coincidence, I happened to be reading this book called Net of Magic, which is an academic text about the tradition of street magic in India. And I went back to the hotel and started looking through the book and seeing the pictures of magicians who looked, you know, they were doing magic that looked nothing like a typical modern American magician. And so I started thinking about this adventure of leaving everything I knew about professional magic behind and traveling to India to find these people and sort of remember why I loved magic in the first place.
You have a conversation with your wife about this. And how did you come to that conclusion? I mean, from the, well, I could teach, I could go back to school, I could do all these. How did the two of you decide, okay, you know what? Pitch it all and travel across the world.
Yeah, you need to remember that this, I, I was 26 years old, and it's not, I hadn't had this job for a few years. Like most people who are 26, they've been in their job for a couple of years. I had been working daily as a magician since I was 9, trying to become a great magician. And, you know, everything I've ever done from age 9 on has been, I was sort of a weird little kid. I didn't have other, this is all I've ever wanted to do. And I hit Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours of study and practice the summer I turned 22. That's a lot of hours as a kid, right? And so it felt like too much. I had committed too much to this relationship between magic and, you know, it's like my relationship with magic was more like a friendship than an occupation. And it was just, I had put in too much time to walk away.
So why India?
Just because I happened to be reading that book. I could have gone anywhere. You know, there are, every culture in the world has its own tradition of magic. Just like every culture has its own food and its own music and its own art. Magic is a cultural expression more than just a set of techniques. And, you know, so I could have gone anywhere. But I just happened to be reading this book about India. And so that's where I went.
And in setting out on this quest for real magic, you knew that the magicians of India were not using forces beyond their control.
Sure.
So you searched for magicians to find real magic.
I wanted, my thesis was this. If I go watch magicians who are doing magic that's totally different than my own, it will amaze me and I will enjoy that. But what I found instead, and I found those magicians and it was amazing.
Right, and actually we'll wait about
okay,
3 minutes.
Sure,
and you can
fine.
Tell us what you found instead about 10 years ago when you set off on this journey to India. Nate Staniforth is a professional magician. He's just published his book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. And I just got broken. Broken into. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is magician Nate Staniforth. He has just published his book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. He grew up in Ames, Iowa, and Central Iowa fans will get a chance to see him perform at the Temple Theater, April 6th and 7th in Des Moines at 7:30 p.m. And, all right, Nate, we were talking about this moment where you're not feeling the magic anymore. You decide that you're going to travel to India, backpack across India, basically, in search of magic there, in search of magicians who will blow your mind.
Yeah, you know, India has a tradition of magic that's thousands of years old, and it, in many ways, is distinct from Western magic. And so I thought I could travel to India and watch them perform the magic that they've performed for thousands of years, and it would amaze me. And, you know, I wanted to feel how it felt to be in the audience, to not know anything about what I was watching. And I just wanted to be amazed. I wanted to find something that would amaze me. And so I went on this trip with the mission of finding snake charmers and street performers and traditional Indian magicians just to watch and be inspired and sort of try to connect with the roots of my craft. But I found something far more interesting while I was over there, because the process of traveling across that country and looking for magic was far more amazing than any of the illusions that I saw. You know, I saw snake charmers and street performers, and they were amazing, and I'm glad I met them. But far more amazing and magical than that was the process of breaking every sort of pattern that I had in my life. You know, we're all very good at making things ordinary and getting used to the life we have around us. And it's so much easier to live in the story that you tell yourself about the world than the world itself. And when you plunge yourself in a culture so different than your own, it forces you to just wake up and stay awake just so you can get through the day. And that was just, it was staggering. You realize how much we miss in a day-to-day life when we're used to everything around us, how much we're not paying attention, how much is right in front of us that we're not seeing. And I'm glad I met the magicians that I met on my trip, but the total shock to the system of immersing myself in a culture so different from my own was amazing on a day-to-day level, noticing things that I just miss here.
You talked to a lot of people that you met. You asked them about magic, about their feelings about magic. And people were very open, for the most part, to talk about it, although you did have some people say, no, we are now a scientific country, and we don't believe in magic, and stop it. But as open as people were to talk to you about that, I'm curious, if you had been asking the same questions here, if you'd been able to chuck the routine and go in search of wonder at home and try to start those conversations, do you think people would have been as open?
I do, yeah. And that was one of the great lessons for me. If you want to find wonder in your daily existence, you don't have to go to India. You can find it right where you are. It took, for me, going to the other side of the country to realize that, or going to the other side of the world to realize that. But yeah, I think in many ways it's more about how you look than where you look. And, you know, you can find, and I use the word wonder, but people find it in so many different ways and call it so many different things. But everybody has something that sort of wakes you up and reminds you that you're alive and it's good to be alive. And you can find that in music and movies and basketball and poetry and sunrises and sunsets and the night sky and barbecue. You know, you can find it anywhere if you remember to look for it.
I would love for you to read a little bit from your book. Now, you mentioned that finding the street musicians that or magicians that lived in the slums. That's an incredible story. And you talk to so many different people. The stories are amazing. But I would love for you to read a little bit from a night that you spent on the Ganges River.
Yeah.
And you got to witness a ceremony, an annual ceremony. Tell me what the ceremony was.
Well, so let me set this into the context of my day. So the way I discovered very early on that doing magic for people was an amazing way to experience a culture, because, you know, there's a difference between the tourist version of a country and the day-to-day experience of the people who live there. And I wanted the day-to-day experience. I didn't want to just see the sights. So in the morning, I just start doing magic for you know, at the market or by the river, and invariably someone would see it and think, oh, that's amazing. Why don't you come to my brother's tea stand and do magic for him? And then I'd do magic at the tea stand. And then one of the people there, one of the customers, would invite me for lunch. And you just sort of, by sharing magic with people, I got to sort of see the inside of the culture and get passed around from person to person who wanted to share it.
And also you got to meet people that you weren't searching for.
Right.
Like a tantric yogi, not something that you had set out to find.
Not on the list, for sure. Right. But it was, you know, you just, by sharing magic with one person, they would want to share it with the people that they know. So they'd introduce me. And so I was in a town called Rishikesh, in the very northern part of the country, right in the foothills of the Himalayas. And I did magic for this woman who was studying in an ashram there. And she invited me to go to this ceremony in a town called Hardwar, just south of Rishikesh, I believe. And so I just was traveling with her because she had seen me do magic and wanted to share this with me. So we went to this ceremony, and, you know, I knew nothing going in about what I was seeing. I didn't understand any of the theology. I didn't understand any of the tradition. None of that was available to me. So all I had were my five senses. You know, I was just there taking it all in. And the sun went down, and they were releasing these candle, sort of floating candles in this river. The river was flowing through the crowd of people. So there are thousands of people there on the banks of the river, and floating down the river are these bright candles just sailing away into the night.
All right, yeah, read a little bit of what you experienced.
I was standing near the edge of the water when the singing began. Until then, the music had been scattered, with some people singing one song and some another, and others not singing at all. But then everyone, some 5,000 people, began singing the same song, quietly, and a current passed through the crowd. This was magic. I don't know how else to say it. This was one of the most magical moments of my life. This was the meteor shower in the night sky and the sound of the piano. This was awe. This was wonder. A family stood next to me, a boy, maybe four, his older sister and their parents, all quietly singing the death knell of everything I had ever done as a magician. This was more amazing. This was better. take my best moments on stage, the lottery illusion at the bar or the coin vanishing on the playground, and this night raised up with song and moon and fire wins every time. This felt the way magic should feel. This felt true. I've been trying for years to identify exactly why so much of the magic in my culture disappointed me, including my own. The real issue is that so often magic doesn't feel true. It doesn't make you say, aha, yes, I remember that. I knew that once. Years ago, I came across the idea that truly great works of art instruct less than they remind. When you listen to Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind, or walk through Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois, or watch old videos of Michael Jordan at the height of his powers, the experience is not one of discovering something new, but rediscovering something old within yourself. These pieces of art and feats of athleticism are bigger than the artist's personal experience. They resonate on a universal human level, and we find in them pieces of our own selves that we may have forgotten in the daily business of living. I didn't understand the words of the song. I didn't know the meaning of the lights or the candles. None of the specific theology of the moment was available to me. It didn't matter. Whatever it was that rose up from that particular combination of sound, fire, darkness, and water transcended theology. It was bigger and more fundamental, like real magic.
Nate Staniforth reading from his book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. And the book is a wonderful reminder to all of us to look at our world, to not take it for granted, to see the beauty and the wonder that's around us. But for you as a performer, I mean, clearly that was one of the major lessons that you got out of your journeys was, oh, I need to be in the moment and pay attention to the world around me. As a performer, how has that changed what you do?
So my time in India totally changed my understanding of my relationship with the audience. When I came back from India, I realized that I wasn't really supposed to be entertaining them. I wasn't supposed to be making them laugh. I wasn't trying to dazzle them with special effects. If you want special effects, go see the new Star Wars movie. If you want comedy, go see a comedian. The thing that a magician can give you, maybe better than any of the other arts, is an encounter with that moment of wonder. That's what a magician can say, honestly. And my show changed so much because instead of trying to entertain the audience, I was just trying to share something with them. So I lost the jokes. I lost, you know, when you come to one of my shows, it doesn't really feel like a show. It's just me talking with the audience. And then, you know, 8 or 9 times in an hour, something really impossible happens. And, you know, it's more like a poetry reading than a magic show in the way that most people thinking about magic shows, because that's what matters to me. You know, I don't care about show business. I don't even really like show business, but I love sharing this experience that I love so much with a room full of people. And so that's how it changed.
How have you, or have you, found balance? I mean, that life on the road, that is part of your reality. And as a professional magician, it's always going to be part of your reality. Now you not only have a wife that you miss when you're on the road, but 2 great kids that you miss when you're on the road. Have you found a way to balance these 2 parts of your life?
No, I really haven't. I'm still very much figuring this out as I go. The book was nice because it was, you know, work that I could be doing while I was home. But I mean, you landed on the central conflict right now. I have this thing that I really want to share with people, but it pulls me away from my home. You know, with family and a home, it takes a really good reason to leave. I know there are performers who love going out on tour and love that sort of rock star lifestyle. And if I could find a way to do my work as a magician without that, I would say goodbye to it and never miss it. It is a requirement and not something that I'm drawn to, but I do love the shows and I do love sharing this thing with people.
In your daily life, do you consciously make an effort to find and recognize wonder?
Sure. Yeah, especially now after having wrestled with all of these ideas before. And in my career as a magician, you know, a magician, if a magician doesn't believe in the magic on some level, it's not magic. And so in order to do my work, I need to have a relationship with those experiences as well. And, you know, it helps to have kids. I have a 2-year-old, and for the longest time, he would insist every night that we go outside and say goodnight to the stars, which sounds sort of funny until you do it, and it's not funny at all. It's just, it's this incredibly beautiful moment, and I'd look forward to it every night. And things like that, small practices, just to remember that, you know, whatever your sense of the world and whatever your cosmology, you know, what is actually true is actually far bigger and far wilder and far more mysterious than you know.
The moment for most of us who don't maybe think about this very much, but one of the big moments in life where magic becomes real for many people is when they become a parent.
Yeah.
And that came for you after all of this soul searching, after all of these thoughts about wonder. What was it like for you to become a dad and be mindful of that?
Yeah, I mean, you can just see in little kids that they are new in the world, and everything has the potential to be amazing. You know, they see things without having already written them off as ordinary and unimportant. And so, you know, it's a constant reminder for me to not take, you know, the parts of my day for granted that would be easy to take for granted as an adult.
You perform and you're doing theater shows. How much of your time do you spend now developing new illusions, new tricks for your show?
Yeah, so I divide my year up into touring months and inventing months, because it's really hard for me to do. I mean, when I go on tour, the hours are still as ridiculous as they ever were. And so when I go on tour, I'm just doing my show. And, you know, it's enough work just to get from city to city and keep the show on the road. But when I come home, you know, I don't have another job. I don't have anything else that I do. And so I have, you know, months to sit down and think, if I was watching a magic show, what could I see that would take my breath away? And then slowly find a way to make it real.
One of the things that comes up many times in your book is the rubber band trick.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty simple magic trick, but it amazes and delights. And it's something you travel with a friend in the book, and you taught him how to do it. And he's not a magician, but he's done this trick all over the world as an icebreaker. Do you think we should all have a magic trick?
I will say this. I think everyone should learn one great piece of magic, because you see a side of humanity that is just kept hidden in private most of the time. You know, most of us, and I don't say this as a criticism because I'm sure I do it too, but we're all sort of performing for each other all the time, right? Down to the clothes you wear and the words you choose. Like, we're all sort of projecting out into the world the way we want the world to see us. And this incredible thing happens when you do something that looks impossible, because it short circuits that process for everyone around you. And the moment something impossible happens, they don't have enough energy to be cool. And so that all of those facades just come crashing down. And for a moment, you get to see this open, unguarded side of people that is normally kept private. I just went to do magic in a maximum security prison. And you could see before I did magic that these guys were not into this. But then the magic happened. And for a moment, they were just like little kids again.
Well, Nate Staniforth, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Nate Staniforth is a magician. He just published his new book, Here is Real Magic, A Magician's Search for Wonder in the Modern World. And Iowans will get another opportunity to see him perform. Des Moines Performing Arts will be hosting Nate for a show on April 6th and 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Temple Theater. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
The same old tingle that I feel inside. And then that elevator.